TLC uploaded Sutton Foster's Say Yes to the Dress.
I saw that.
Was like, wait, what? Is she getting married again? And then I scrolled down and the first comment was like, don't worry, she's still married. And I was like, oh, okay. So other people, like,
yes, I needed that.
I've had this question.
Two people stranded at sea. Two people stranded are we. We are.
Welcome everyone to Bottomless Broadway, where we talk musicals over mimosas. We are still working through the very long list of new musicals in 2024, and today we're going to talk about Days of Wine and Roses. I dreaded listening to the music because I was just like, this isn't going to be fun. So I didn't start until like this morning, but it's growing on me.
I know. Okay, I was going to say that too. Do you have a 5 words to begin with?
I literally didn't think that hard, and my 5 words was just going to be, I'm shocked I like this. I think the music is making me like the show more, actually, the more I listen to the lyrics. And when I first saw the show, I was like, the show's good. I'm not bored. Things are great. But like, we were both like, the music's very unpleasant. So to me, I was like, the show's good. The music is unpleasant, but you know, it tells a story fine. A solid like B show. But yeah, there's just a lot to pick at in the songs, and I'm liking it more because of the music, which is like so opposite of what I thought.
Yeah, my 5 words is could be a two-hander, because if you look at the song list, basically only two people are allowed to sing, and the kid is allowed on some tracks. And otherwise, they're like, this is the Kelly O'Hara and Brian D'Arcy James show. And honestly, I think if they just reworked it slightly, they could have just made it a cast of two people. Like, I mean, you just don't see that a lot in shows, right? Where you have a cast of, what is it? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 people. And like, only two people are ever actually like real characters.
Yeah.
I like the show. I saw it off Broadway as well. I don't think it really changed much at all between off Broadway and on Broadway. The music did kind of grow on me. They released the cast album super early. I think it was maybe right at the beginning of their Broadway previews, or maybe even before their Broadway previews began. And for the second time watching it, I was like, okay, I'm going to listen to the music a bunch more so that that way it'll be like, I won't have the music kind of distracting me, I guess, from the story. And I think that kind of helped on the second watch. I didn't hate it on the first watch. I was just kind of like, there's a lot going on right now between the music and the plot, and like, it's a really heavy story. But yeah, like the music definitely, it works for me now, still except for
Under Death,
but we'll get there. Yeah.
It makes sense in a way where it's like, at the most strenuous parts of the plot, the music is the most unpleasant.
Yeah. And Adam Gettle, who is the composer lyricist, he has not written a ton of other things, but his most well-known is Light in the Piazza. I feel like this might be a hot take, but I like individual songs on Light in the Piazza better, but I feel like overall this is a more listenable score. He's always done kind of like different things. Like, I don't think he believes in choruses in any of his songs. They're all kind of more stream of consciousness.
Yeah, and it's very impressive how great Kelly O'Hara and Brian D'Arcy James sound with like such dissonance all the fucking time. I don't know if you like ever sang in a choir or something. When the harmonies make sense, you're just like, yeah, like I got this. I don't need to think
about
it. It
just like clicks in.
Yeah, but they're just like in constant dissonance. So I just feel like, I just want to know like if it's very mentally taxing that they're just like always thinking about how they need to sound because it's not what makes sense, which is very impressive. But still, like, it's never something that I'm going to, like, start humming in a car and be like, oh my God, you know what I really want to put on? Days of Wine and Roses.
Yeah, and I think it was kind of written for Kelly and Brian, because Kelly, I think, was the first one that approached Adam Gettle with the idea, or they had just, like, talked about it together, because she was in the original Light in the Piazza, and she had already worked with Brian D'Arcy James at that point. And I really do love both of their voices on this. Like, I think it just really fits them well. And it is very impressive how well they are able to sing this.
I did read some like forum reviews. And it just seems like people fall into two categories of like, this is impossible to listen to and truly awful. And people who are like, it doesn't need to sound good. It's telling a story, which it would be nice if it sounded good, but this is what we're working with.
Yeah. Did you want to give a summary?
Yes. I'm like swallowing a gusher, which is apparently really hard to do. So Days of Wine and Roses, like you said, is basically just about two people. It's kind of set like mid last century, very Mad Men era. They're falling in love and navigating their relationship, raising a child, but it's all underscored heavily by their increased alcohol consumption and then eventual addiction. So at the start of the play, we have Joe Clay, who's played by Brian D'Arcy James. He's this like charismatic, sleazy PR exec. He mentions that he's a PR exec several times. And then first scene, he's like sending up girls to his clients at a club or something, talking a big game, pushing drinks on everyone. Kirsten is a secretary at the same company. I think like the secretary to the CEO or something, like someone important, which is why Joe wants to approach her. She abstains from alcohol and Joe tries to like put his charm on her, and she's basically immediately repulsed. Kirsten has a really good head on her shoulders at the beginning of this show. She like seems like an ingenue, but is way smarter. So Joe pulls back and basically tries to give her this nice guy treatment, I guess. He's like, sorry, I shouldn't have approached you that way. Like, that's not who I am. At least for me, I'm like, oh, this is progressing towards the equally toxic, but much more common trope where she's going to save him. But instead, he just corrupts her and introduces her to alcohol via, no shock, a very sweet cocktail. The two like date, fall in love, get married, continue drinking. Their relationship starts to get strained when Kirsten gives birth to a daughter. And like during this period and the breastfeeding, she can't drink. She does pick up right after. And like the less ideal relationship they now have drive them both to drink even more, until eventually Joe gets demoted for underperforming and showing up to work drunk all the time. And around the same time, Kirsten passes out drunk and burns down their apartment building with like her and her daughter still in the apartment. They make it out, but they go and seek refuge at Kirsten's father's place outside of the city and begin what is like, optimistically speaking, a very shaky recovery and relapse period that goes throughout the rest of the play. Yeah.
So it opens with magic time, which is when Joe, it's like, I think implied that he's holding this sort of party on a boat or something, and he's just like hiring girls to be eye candy or something. It's like a little unclear, but also pretty tough. He actually mistakes Kirsten as one of the girls he's hired. And she's like, I literally work with you. I spell checked your draft of this thing where you spelled all these things wrong. And he got really offended at that. At this point, he's like drinking as part of his job. He likes drinking. He's shocked that Kirsten doesn't drink at all. One thing to mention, the song opens with this little refrain of two people stranded at sea, two people stranded are we, which does come back. The whole sea motif is there.
Yeah. Actually, now that you mention it, the music kind of feels watery.
Watery or alcohol-y?
It just feels like Cool Ripple is how some of the jazzy-ish chamber music sounds sometimes.
Yeah. I think that's probably on purpose. But yeah, I just wanted to bring up this line because they sing it when they're standing directly at the front of the stage facing the audience, and then they sort of start the scene, because spoiler alert, the story does not really end well. I guess if anything, it's kind of a morality tale or a cautionary tale sort of thing. I mean, it does also just sort of depict alcoholism in a really empathetic way.
I feel like it's realistic, but not like completely tragic.
Yeah.
Well, in this song, and I think the next two songs, it subtly like hints you into the alcoholism because, well, in this song, you know, Joe's like, it's just for fun. Everyone's relaxing. It's after work. Like, it's not a big deal. But then there are lines where he's like, oh, alcohol gives me a lift.
Okay. So hi there. How about a drink? What's your fancy? Let me get you something fun. A satchel pay.
No thanks.
A sobriquet.
Nope.
A Jean Hart.
to drink? And isn't she dead?
She is.
The next one is when she just like agrees to go out with him.
I don't know why she agrees.
Yeah, that part was not really made clear because he has not really put his best foot forward at all. This is a plot device at this point. They need to go on a date. It doesn't matter why. He keeps pressing her about why she doesn't drink. She says she just doesn't like the taste, and he asks her what she does like, and she says chocolate. So then he gets the waiter to bring a Brandy Alexander, which I don't know if that's just not a thing anymore or just something that I've never heard of, but it's right? like a very chocolate like a flavored drink. Yeah, basically. Yeah.
I actually really like Story of Atlantic Cable. I don't know why. I just feel like, you know, I don't mind a little history lesson.
I like it just because I like Kelly's voice on it. I feel like what happens in a lot of these songs is there's just like a really vague sort of metaphor being painted, and I don't quite know what the metaphor is. Like, obviously the Atlantic Cable means something if he named a whole song after it, and also she tells the entire story mm-hmm. of it in song. And like, I'm guessing it's about communication or just like reaching out to people, but it's like I don't quite have the metaphor mm-hmm. in focus. But unlike something like Here Lies Love, where I was just like, I don't know what he's talking about at all, I'm like, I trust that he had an idea for this in mind.
So like, I'm gonna try, and I don't think I'm going to get to the heart of what the song means. I feel like there's a seriously deep meaning, but it still makes me like this mm-hmm. song a lot. Atlantic Cable has to do with the first line in the song of two people being stranded at sea, because it's literally like communicating across the ocean. Mm-hmm. One of the purposes is definitely just like characterizing Kirsten as this smart, well-read woman who cares about things that like a lot of women in the 50s and 60s typically weren't known to care about. She's telling the story. Joe is like, I cannot believe I'm hearing about this on a date. Like, this is absolutely insane, right? And she's just like enjoying herself. She's not super like self-aware in terms of like whether or not this date is good. Like, if she's impressing him, she just doesn't seem to care. She's just herself. And what surprised me when I listened to this is when she's talking about the Atlantic Cable, Joe genuinely doesn't seem interested. Like, at the end of this song, I do feel like he gets a little bit impressed by her, maybe, but maybe it's just the alcohol. Like, I don't feel like there's a click when they talk about the Atlantic Cable. Then she moves on from the Atlantic Cable, and right before she starts on the Niagara Falls, which is her next date topic, apparently, he orders her Brandy Alexander. So she starts drinking, and then she talks about the Niagara Falls, and that's when Joe's actually engaging. They don't really click in a conversation until she has some alcohol in her system, which I feel you can really tell from the song, which is really cool. The other thing is, what she says about the Niagara Fall is every year people try to cross under it or something in like barrels and other shit that you shouldn't go into the ocean with. And she's like, it's really stupid because most of them die. Who knows why they try? I sort of know the reason. And Joe's like, why? And Kirsten says, well, to find out, which is just very foreshadowy and for addiction. Like, have you seen that famous Reddit where that guy is like, I want to do meth once just to try it out. And then he comes back like 8 years later and he's like, guys, it ruined my life. But yeah, like, I feel like her being like, well, I know why they just went and sailed to their death to find out, which is also just very addictive personality-esque.
Yeah.
And then she talks about the Senate, which is like just some great feminist stuff of like, there's not enough women on the Senate. And Joe is literally just like, yeah, I agree. But I really don't think there's any conviction. Like, I'm fairly certain he's still just trying to sleep with her. He's like such a bad person at the beginning of this show, and they almost make you forget it at the end.
I know. The Joe character arc is wild in this show. Like, he just like starts already kind of bad and just gets worse for like the first half of the show. And then you suddenly like him at the end and you're like, yeah, wait a second.
Being sober really did stuff for him.
Yeah, no, I think on the Niagara Falls thing with addiction, I think that sort of leads into the next song as well with mm-hmm. There I Go, because she's talking about, oh, I love a bolted door. Let me in there. Let me see. Danger, hazard, they make me happy. If I get lost, then, well, there I go. And it's just like she likes to push the boundaries, which is also probably why she's so well read. But then again, like you said, that sort of probably leads to her addiction. And I mean, it's not like she's never had alcohol before, because, you know, she said she didn't like the taste, so she must have tried it at least once. But now that she has, like, I guess, a personally curated cocktail list by from Joe,
that she throws away immediately for straight whiskey.
Also that. So she just really needed that entry point of it being chocolate. And then she was like, you know what? I can take tequila shots now. And the thing is, the song is like a really kind of inspirational song. Like, the song makes you think, oh yeah, like, we should, you know, really try to strive for things beyond our reach. But then when you think about it in the full context of the show, you're like, oh shit, girl, don't do it.
So I didn't see it that way at all. And this goes back to earlier when Joe's like, what do you do to lift your spirits? And she's like, I just need chocolate. Like, I don't need anything stronger than chocolate. Because he asks her something like, what's your, you know, depressing backstory? He phrases it in some charming way. And she's just like, get the fuck out of here. Like, I don't have one. I don't need alcohol. Which is also how I was when I was 18, because I remember being a college freshman and being like, I don't need to drink. I just can't imagine anything making me happier than ice cream. Which sometimes when I try a really good ice cream, I still kind of agree with. She's just like, I don't need my spirits uplifted. She just feels very genuinely goody two shoes in a way that it's like she's just happy being herself somehow. But right. Then in this song, I actually feel like it's completely opposite of that. And you're just like, oh, like, I don't know if she just tapped into this because she just had her first drink, or like if this is always who she's been, because she's, even though, like, yeah, it's kind of cool where she's like, I like danger. There's some ugly imagery in this song that really conveys danger. And she starts the song with like jagged cliffs and hieroglyphs. And at the end, when she says, they make me feel it's not ideal, that's something that just screams addiction in general. Like, whenever right. you hear someone talk about addiction, they're just like, oh, like, I don't want to feel stuff, and that's why I did all these drugs. And it's just like, how is someone who's never even considered alcohol in her whole life and didn't feel like she needed it saying those words, they make me feel it's not ideal? Mm-hmm. So I was actually just like, ooh, yeah, something's wrong with her.
Yeah, interesting. I did think that it was a little strange that, because she seems like a very sheltered kid, right? Mm-hmm. The whole, you know, abandoned buildings, jagged cliffs, newborn stars, and hieroglyphs. I saw that kind of because she said that for her like 12th birthday or something, her dad got her a set of encyclopedias. And so I saw that as like her sort of conquering her curiosity. And so she thought maybe that she had, you know, done that with alcohol when she tried it and didn't like it before. But now it's kind of like a whole new world is opened up to her. And because she has this sort of like thirst for knowledge and curiosity and wants to just, I guess, say she's done everything, maybe that is maybe why she sort of like fully throws herself into the alcoholic lifestyle.
Yeah.
And also, I think it sort of comes back at the end too, when, I mean, we're going to spoil the whole show, but when Joe starts getting sober and he starts going to AA meetings, and, you know, he has this whole like program that he's going through about like things he can and can't do. And she's like, well, you can just stop. Like, I don't need to go to some stupid meeting to just stop. And I think like that's the same folly that she is sort of experiencing here, where she's just like, I can just hop over this fence kind of idealism of like, oh, it's no big deal. Like, I can just do that. And I mean, obviously she can't really, or just like doesn't want to try because of the whole like, it makes me feel it's not ideal part. So I think it does actually do a lot for her character. And it feels almost like a surrender into this sort of life of danger that she's describing, kind of.
Yeah.
She's like, oh, well, it's not ideal, but there go I. It's fine.
Interesting. Yeah, I feel like there's so much going on in There Go I and Story of the Anti Cable. I don't know. I feel like Kirsten is more so the main character of this show.
I mean, she gets like all the songs except for... yeah. Three.
Yeah.
Some things I can't ignore. I can't ask why, what for. I love a bolted door. Let me in there. Let me see. desert. Make me happy.
But then we go into a duet of them, Evanescence, which is very upbeat.
It's actually just Evanescence.
Oh, whoops. Evanescence.
This was probably the first song that I heard, and I was like, okay, this is a real song. I think it actually has kind of a cool melody. It's like a very fun song. They have like a repeated refrain. It still sounds different than your standard musical theater song, but it sounds slightly more familiar territory. And then you listen to the lyrics and you're like, these lyrics are whack.
Like, yeah.
Like, it sounds like such a joyful song. And then they're talking just about like
dying,
basically dying.
Yeah. So basically, at this point, they are officially dating. And it's unclear if Kirsten is still working at a secretary, but it seems like she's more or less starting to embrace the housewife life, the Betty Draper life. Because also in the first scene, she's dressed like a secretary, and now she's dressed more like a 60s wife. She's waiting at home. Joe comes home with just like a ton of alcohol and brown bags. And he's like, we're going to celebrate because I got promoted. And at this point, it seems like he's still good at his job. Like in the first song, he's sleazy, but it seems like he's good at his job, you know? So they're like, oh my God, let's celebrate. And he's basically like pouring champagne, making her a margarita, and then pouring straight whiskey. And they're just super excited and singing. It seems like they're singing about how excited they are, although they're not. And then the chorus is kind of a love song where they're like, I have you. But the verse itself is, yeah. I mean, the dolphins are really where it gets creepy.
Yeah. Two dolphins break in a wave. Two dolphins right to the grave.
Sometimes I feel like I'm riding on an arrow on the needle of a compass, just a gust of air, leaning out the window. I'm running with the knife. I'm riding on an arrow. I'm running for my life. Those are literally just like, oh, you are walking a thin line in most of these lines. And in the other ones, you're just straight up falling to your death.
It's just like, how self-aware are they? Is the question here, right? Because they're like dancing around with these bottles of alcohol. The way that Joe walks in with them looks like he's preparing for a frat party. It looks like it's right before you're about to throw a rager. And I guess they're just drinking it all by themselves.
They repeat the riding on an arrow portion, like riding on an arrow on the needle of a compass, spinning counterclockwise. And then that followed by just a gust of air. You're walking a really thin line. Things are teetering. And then I feel like just a gust of air is literally like, what kills you if you are walking on the needle of a compass?
I think it might also just be an indication of how much their relationship might rely on the alcohol.
Yeah, we haven't seen them bond without it.
Yeah. And it also seems like they're pushing each other to drink more, because after I saw the show, I had this question of like, well, Joe was always drinking for his job. And it's not like he had a problem that we really noticed before. He's been doing this job for a while. And it, like, I mean, later on, we see that the alcoholism really affects his ability to do his job. But at this point, you know, he just got promoted. It seems like he's doing great. Mm-hmm. So, like, my theory is that they sort of just kept pushing each other to drink more.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably also what this is talking about with, like, with all this water everywhere, riding on an arrow, I'm running for my life. Like, it's kind of just, if you stop doing this, then the life as they have, because it seems like they've moved in together at this point.
I think they want to stay together because they're having a lot of fun and they're attracted to each other, but they don't know how to be together without alcohol.
And it has like, who needs dry land? Who needs wet sand? All I want is you.
What really bothers me is they give you the recipe for a margarita, but instead of tequila, they say, you got your bubbly, which just sounds like you're putting champagne in there. It's you got your bubbly, your Cointreau, your lime, your Morton salt.
Yeah, that is weird. What are they drinking?
Otherwise, yeah. Really fun song.
Two dolphins breaking away. Two dolphins ride to the grave. Sometimes I feel like I am riding on an arrow.
Sometimes I feel like I am riding on an arrow.
On the needle of a compass.
On the needle of a
spinning
compass.
Spinning counterclockwise.
Spinning counterclockwise.
Just a gust of air. With all this water everywhere.
At some point, they get married. They just show up at her dad's place in the middle of the night. And she's like, "Dad, I have someone I want you to meet." Her dad is not having it. He's like, "First of all, you never come home. And when you do come home, you drag this man with you," who he like basically hates immediately. Might be a little undeserved, seeing as he met Joe for maybe like 2 minutes. But
fair. I guess Kirsten also hated him upon first sight. So yeah. I don't think he's likable. And then he just catches her making out with her daughter really hard in his backyard and then gets told that they're married. So, you know.
Yeah, it was probably not reasonable the best way to introduce.
You know, maybe he wasn't the best influence on her. And then they have a kid.
Yeah, I mean, fair enough. And then they have a kid. Yeah.
Which all happens before the next song.
Yeah. And the next one is basically just a lullaby that her mom sang to her, and now she's singing to her kid. I don't know. I mean, I think it's like a nice song. Somani Heyman.
And this is before Joe comes home?
Yes.
Okay. So they had a kid. We don't see her pregnant or anything, but she has a baby and now she's breastfeeding, so she's not drinking. And she sings this lullaby to Lila, her new daughter, while she waits for Joe to come home from work.
I guess the book scene is the more important part of this, where Joe's coming home from work and he's upset that he spends all day at work. It's such a classic. He spent all day at work and he wants to come home and have sex with his wife, and his wife is super tired because she spent the whole day taking care of the baby and she won't even have a drink with him because she's breastfeeding. And this is like peak Joe douchebag moment, I think.
Mm-hmm. It is a classic fight, but it's like escalated. Most people are like, "You do the dishes. I've been watching the baby all day." And the guy's like, "No, I've been at work all day." But it's literally like he comes home drunk because he's still drinking at work. And she's miserable because she can't drink. And he's just like, "Why don't you just drink?" And she's like, "No, I'm breastfeeding." And I feel like he's convinced that if she'll just drink, she'll have energy to have sex with him. And and she's just like, "No, I have to breastfeed." And he's like, "I don't really understand why you have to breastfeed. Like, formula exists. Just do that." And she's like, "That's right. Ridiculous. Like, I can breastfeed. Why would I not?" And he's like, "Well, you're going to lose your boobs." And that was really his peak douchebag moment.
Also, just one clarification, when you said that she was miserable because she wasn't drinking. Like, she did say, she's like, "Oh, it's so nice to be clear headed.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you should try it." Yeah. Which also just shows how much they were fucking drinking. The fact that being clear-headed is unusual for them means that they're probably spending more time drunk than they are not.
I feel like a little bit she's gaslighting herself, but at least her daughter, she has the self-control to not drink, which she doesn't have later on.
I think it was more just because it was something they did together, and she was more feeling FOMO about he was like out having fun without her sort of thing. And I think that's why she was like maybe trying to convince him to not drink, because she was like, "Oh, we can still have fun together even if we're not drinking." I saw it more as that rather than like her
that
wanting to drink. Because as we mentioned, their whole relationship is built on drinking. So if she didn't have that, what did she have? Nothing, apparently, except a child. She does end up pouring herself a drink just to basically appease him, because he is like a little bit scary angry at this point. Like, he's like scary drunk angry, you know? So because he's like a little scary, he basically says sorry by singing the song "As the Water Loves a Stone," which is also another metaphor that I don't quite get, except maybe just like everything leads back to him loving her. Let me just read the whole thing, because it's just, "There is a man who loves you as the water loves the stone, and the stone adores the hillside where the wind has always blown, and the wind pursues the rain cloud up as high as it will go, and the cloud then turns at last to love the water far below, so everything is circular and nothing is alone, and the man who loves you as the water loves the stone." Is it just the idea that like, oh, the water will come back to the stone even after the whole water cycle?
I don't know. I feel like it's like, there's no love if there's no liquids. Okay, so he's talking about water evaporating into the clouds, coming down, basically leaving the stone, but coming back.
Yeah.
Okay, so maybe that's it. He's like, "Sometimes I'm a douchebag, but I'll come back," which he does.
I mean, I think that's probably about as close as we're going to get.
This is the first time I've thought seriously about the song. It kind of just like washes.
It has
over
bothered
me
since the first time I heard it.
Oh, really?
Because this is his apology song. I'm
but
like,
you know, people like use the weirdest analogies for love that I feel like I'm just like conditioned to no longer think about it. I'm still trying to figure out how to love someone like a love song. Like, I just feel like I've stopped trying to figure out love songs.
Honestly, fair. But the song also, it's like in a minor key. It sounds vaguely sinister. It's not like a sweeping love song. So maybe his analogy is bad. Like, maybe he's not saying what he thinks he's saying. And then, of course, there's also more of the like water imagery.
That's
maybe
true.
Water is their relationship, and he's like, the water cycle happens and we'll have ups and downs. Maybe that's what he's saying, because he does
or
say everything is circular.
The water is the alcoholism, and he's like, mm-hmm. It's gonna come back for you.
That's foreboding.
I mean, I don't think that's what he's trying to say in the moment, but you know, like in Evan Ness, they're also saying a lot of stuff that like I don't think they mean in the moment, but it's just like,
yeah,
oh. But because water just seems to come back into this show because it's alcohol. Yeah, I feel like it's like, as the alcohol loves you and will always come back mm-hmm. for you.
Yeah, I guess I could see that. Also, it's just like hard to escape because yeah. It'll keep coming back.
There is a man who loves you as the water loves the stone, and the stone adores the hillside where the wind has always blown. And the wind pursues the rain cloud up as high as it will go. And the cloud then turns at last to love the water far below. So everything is circular and nothing is alone.
And yeah. And then we fast forward 7-8 years.
Yeah. Which, Are You Blue is a pretty fun song. Well, it's fun out of context because she's just like having fun scatting and being like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not sad.
Joe got demoted. And so now he has to work out of town most weeks, which I feel like just makes Kirsten sadder and drink more. And he's coming home and the house looks like shit, and she's supposed to like clean it to welcome her husband home from his business trip, and she's not doing it. So Lila's doing it. And then when she sees Lila do it, she like feels bad. So she's like, no, I can vacuum.
And this sort of leads directly into Underdeath.
I'm surprised you thought this was a fun song, because it's like about as unpleasant as Underdeath to me.
It's like, I mean, it has that sort of sinister undertone to it, but I like the scatting. I like her voice on it a lot, especially when it goes into those like, hell no, not me. I think that part, like, she just really shines.
She also looks so pathetic. It's like really sad because her costuming is actually like really well done, because like I said, in the first scene, she looks like your office girl. Afterwards, she looks like your housewife. Like your happy, hot housewife. In the scene before this, when Lila's a baby and they're fighting, she's in her like long nightgown, like very like Mrs. Maisel nightgown, like she's being a good young mom nightgown. You know what I'm talking about? And then at this point, like she looks so disheveled, like her hair's not done. She basically just wears this big, ugly cardigan covering her whole body around the house because she's drunk all the time.
Also, like chain smoking too.
Oh, yeah.
Is important. Yeah, so then after she actually, is this the same scene as Underdeath, or is it just more of like a montage kind of thing?
I think it's the same scene.
They're playing hide and seek. She, I think, is supposed to be the one hiding, which is different from how it normally is. And her daughter finds her like fairly easily because she's just like very drunk. And she is just like, let me tell you about the Underdeath. Which is really kind of terrifying. Like, if this happened to me, I would be like, my mother is a crazy person. It's just such an unpleasant song to listen to. And it's like, you can tell that Kirsten knows she's kind of in trouble with being drunk all the time, because she's like, oh, like, I would never allow my daughter to go there. But I go there every day. It like, I can't find a way out. And then Lila's sort of scared off by this, and reasonably so. And then Kirsten just sort of collapses with a lit cigarette in her hand, and that's how they end up burning the apartment down.
Yeah. when she sings, it's like such a staccato. Like, it's just so uncomfortable to listen to.
Yeah.
It like gives me chicken skin. It's just like one of those sounds. Yeah. That is just like, oh.
I would always listen up until Underdeath, and I'd get to Underdeath and I'd be like, you know, I don't know if I can do this anymore.
There were a couple times when I considered listening to this album, like in preparation of this recording. But because it was dark outside, I was like, no, I'm good. I don't want to like scare myself when Underdeath comes on.
I know a place called Underdeath, Underdeath. And where is that, you say? It is Underdeath, of course, my girl. Your mommy goes there every day. It is under here and under how and under you and under now. It's under where I won't allow my girl to ever go. Why is that? Why is that? Don't you know how much I love you? 'Cause Underdeath is Underdeath, is Underdeath.
So they live in an apartment building in the city. The whole place is damaged. And so like the next scene is just her neighbors shaming her and being like, can't believe you did that when you had a daughter in your house. Like, what is wrong with you? You should be so ashamed. You burned my heirlooms. Like, you're a terrible person. Yeah. And she's like super ashamed. And all she can tell the police is like, I don't remember what happened. And it's like unclear if they're going to press charges on her to replace the building. Joe still comes home from his business trip and she's like, please don't leave me. I burned the building down. And he's like, please don't leave me. I got fired. She's like, let's move to my dad's house in like Long Island or something. So they do. And her dad owns like a flower shop / landscaping greenhouse company or something.
Yeah. First Breath is, it really does feel like the first breath you're taking, especially after Underdeath. But the idea is basically like, oh, look, we are both sober now. I feel like I can breathe again. Both my husband and my daughter are doing great. Like, it's amazing. But you're only halfway through the show. So you're like, all right, still got an hour to go. It can't be this easy.
Yeah. So Joe really behaves just like a neutered man for a couple months. I don't know. He's like working for his father-in-law who doesn't even like him and doesn't trust him. He dresses very different. He's not wearing his like big city PR exec suits anymore. He is in kind of like flannel and khakis and stuff and making deliveries for this landscaping plant business. We hit this scene where the father-in-law is kind of testing him, where he's just like, oh, you're not an addict anymore? Well, if you're not an addict anymore, sit down and have a beer with me, just one beer. And Joe is like, oh no, I would never ever dare to drink again, because he knows he's being tested. And then he goes back into Kirsten's room. I believe they're not allowed to sleep together right now because he's like not supposed to be in her room. He's just complaining to her. He's like, your dad is keeping me on such a short leash. Let's just have three entire bottles of whiskey to unwind.
Well, the way that he does this is, it seems like they're about to have sex, right? Because he's doing like a strip tease. He's like, oh, let me put on a show for you. It's actually kind of cute.
She and was into the stripping.
Yeah. Yeah. You can tell Kirsten's like very charmed by this until he like rolls up his pant legs and he just like has these bottles of whiskey like duct taped to his leg, which is also just like kind of funny if you think about it.
Like a grown man doing this.
Yeah. But the whole audience like gasped because it's like, oh, you thought they were doing so well.
So they drink a fuck ton and then they finish two or three entire bottles of liquor. I don't even think they had sex. I don't know. Maybe they did. And they're just like, we're out of drinks now. And Joe is like, lucky for you, I stashed one more bottle in this planter in the greenhouse, which is just stupid. Like, you really couldn't fit one more under your pants. But that is when he sings 4-3-5. Basically, it is how he's remembering how to get to that last bottle. It's like the fourth shelf, third row, fifth planter, whatever, like how he's going to navigate the greenhouse in order to find the alcohol. He's just like, I'm so smart. Like, I hid this bottle so well. And I remember where I hid it. Like, I am such a smart man. You don't know a lot of guys who can keep it all up here. But he struggles to find it because he forgot which side of the greenhouse to start counting from. And he doesn't find it. And because he's so drunk, he gets super frustrated and trashes the entire greenhouse. I think there's also probably like a lot of bottled up resentment towards his father-in-law. He's just like cursing, throwing planters everywhere, trying to find this bottle.
Well, so as he's trashing the greenhouse, he starts having a flashback because he was in the, I assume, Korean War. He thinks that like someone's attacking him or something. He also like, he finds the bottle eventually, and he drinks like half of it by himself. Like, he is not thinking about Kirsten anymore. He's just thinking about how to get his own. And then he starts having this flashback. And basically, I think his father-in-law does find him and calls an ambulance because he basically just overdosed and he is like not well.
I totally forgot this war stuff because that also comes up in their first date. And I feel like it was one of the things that made Kirsten be like, okay, let me give him like three more sentences worth of chance.
Which I thought was really smart to do here because like this is secondary peak asshole for him to start trashing the greenhouse. And like, I know he's drunk and stuff, but it's kind of like, okay, your father-in-law took you in. This is your father-in-law's livelihood. Like, his job is to grow plants in this greenhouse and you're just like completely destroying it because of your like basically selfish need for alcohol. But then when he has the war flashback, you're like, oh, there's a lot of other things sort of feeding into this alcoholism probably. So it really does make you more sympathetic to him. And, you know, it's sort of when you start feeling bad for him, you're like, oh, alcoholism really is an illness. It's not his fault. So yeah, so I thought that was smart. The other thing I wanted to mention about the song is it starts with him also kind of scatting in a very similar way that Kirsten does in Are You Blue? And like, Are You Blue? She's scatting right before the whole like fire happens. And that's kind of a wake up call for her a little bit. And like, you know, they move to her dad's place. And so this is also sort of his wake up call when he ends up in the hospital. That's how he finally gets the contact for his AA program. So then, you know, he has been going to these AA meetings, and his sponsor's name is Jim, who was also a former alcoholic and is basically just the one in charge of keeping Joe on track with not drinking anymore. This has sort of become like a role reversal where now Joe's not drinking, but Kirsten still is because I guess she's just like in too deep now. I don't know. This sort of puzzled me the most about the show is like she's had multiple moments where she's like, oh, it's been nice to be clear-headed, it's been nice to not be drunk. And I guess like maybe she wasn't completely saying that truthfully the whole time, but it was kind of like, oh, well, she had these moments of lucidity where she was not drunk and seemed to enjoy it, but now all of a sudden that Joe's not doing it, she doesn't want to get sober. But I do really like the song, Morton Salt Girl. She feels pretty betrayed that he's going sober, actually. And like she starts off with, what about the church we built? Do I have to go there alone? What about our secret language? Who will I talk to?
You can really see how she sees alcohol as this like cornerstone of her relationship by calling it their church, their secret language. She's also just like, I don't need AA. I can just stop. And she says a line here. I don't understand how like you can be an alcoholic because I just feel like if I need to put away everything that matters to me and all the happiness in my life, if I need to put that aside for 18 years for our daughter, I'll just do that.
She's like, listen, I might have burned down our apartment, but we were all fine. I didn't have to pay a hospital bill for it.
Yeah, it's just like very weird because she seems so mad at him that he had that extreme low point, even though she's also had it.
In Evanesce, when he was pulling out the margarita ingredients, he was like, oh, and you have your Morton Salt Girl ever intrepid, because she's like always in the rain. So she says like, oh, go ahead and leave me abandoned, I'm stronger. And then she lists a bunch of things that she's stronger than. She says stronger than your Morton Salt Girl. And I think it's sort of just like a, I don't need you because I'm stronger. Like, I don't need the Morton Salt Girl that we've joked about. Like, I can just do this on my own. I can drink on my own. And also just another part to point out, she says, what are you afraid of? Is it living?
So it's definitely like she feels that drinking is what makes living exciting.
You con man, go then, leave me, abandon, I'm stronger.
What is forgiveness? I actually don't know if I remember this.
This actually might be my favorite song. This or Evanesce is probably. It's like they're sitting at the diner. He's sitting with Jim, his sponsor. And he's like, I get it now. I understand what I was like put here to do. I'm like going to tell everyone about how great it is being sober. This is what forgiveness is like. I've done a lot of shitty things in my life, but like, this is how I'm going to redeem myself. And he just sort of like sees himself again, I guess, because he's like, I see him now. What of Joe Clay? Is he such a villain? He's just an ordinary guy. It's actually really funny because he sings this very like inspirational song. And then his sponsor was like, man, you're full of shit. Like, he's like, focus on yourself first before you start trying to like preach the word to other people because you've been sober for like a week. And the way that his voice changes register, I just love the way that it sits in Brian D'Arcy James's voice.
And what do we think he should have done with what he was given? He's not a confidence man. Doing what he can. Forgiveness. Forgiveness.
Right after this, it's not on the album, but we have a reprise of As the Water Loves the Stone,
mm-hmm.
which is the motel scene. Basically, Kirsten has moved out.
She literally calls a neighbor over because the neighbor's going to watch her daughter for a couple of hours. And she also sells all of her books and her daughter's books to this neighbor so that she has some seed money for her alcoholism. She leaves her daughter with this neighbor who's agreed to watch her daughter for like one afternoon while she runs errands. And instead, she just disappears to a motel, starts hooking up with random guys.
She's like sleeping with other men who will drink with her because Joe won't. She calls Joe, I think, to come pick her up. Jim is like, don't do it. She'll just drag you in with her. Joe's like, well,
no,
she's still my wife.
Oh, no, the hotel calls.
Oh, the hotel.
He's not interested.
Oh, yeah, because she can't pay the bill.
Yeah. He's like waiting to find her because at this point, it's just like she's left her daughter at home alone and disappeared for a week.
Jim is like, don't do it. And he's like, Jim, you can watch the kid.
Jim wants to go with him. He's like, I'm going to keep you accountable. And he's like
no, you need
fine.
A
it's
buddy.
My wife.
And Kirsten is basically like, oh, well, you know, I still love you, but you won't drink with me. Like, just have one drink. Aren't you a man? I think he does end up drinking there, right?
He
like has one drink.
I think he has a little more than one drink. But the point is, like, he still makes it home the next morning. And Jim is very disappointed in him, which I understand, especially when Jim has warned him so many times, like, your one drink is not the same thing as another person's one drink. Like, you have to be very careful. I understand why he's disappointed. But I actually feel like, just like as a viewer, I feel like Joe handled that pretty well. He literally goes to this motel. He finds Kirsten. He's like, wake up, let's go home. And she's like, oh my God, baby, come join me. And then she's like, oh, it's you. So it's like, she's obviously sleeping with someone else. And then, she makes all these comments like, aren't you a man? And, you know, all he does is drink a little, stay with her one night, and then he comes home to his daughter. So I was like, you know what? That actually showed a lot of restraint.
Kind of proud of him. Yeah. So then Kirsten moves out. She moves in with her dad, who is just like grudgingly taking care of her, I guess. And she's communicating with her daughter through letters. And she's been saying like, oh, mommy's sick. Don't worry. I'll get better soon. And then I'll be able to see you again. It's just this illness that's keeping me away from you, which sounds promising when you hear it. And then you realize she's actually not really doing anything to
she's
try
really
to
trying.
Change it. Yeah, because Joe goes by the house and basically just like gets into an argument with him where he's just like, oh, listen, like, I feel really bad. I'm doing better now. I want to pay you back for the greenhouse. And her dad just like yells at him. And he's like, you fucked up her entire life. She was fine before she met you. Like, you got her into this. I have no clue where she is because she just goes out every night and who knows what she's getting up to, which honestly, fair. But I did also feel bad for Joe because it's like, I mean, he's trying.
It feels like the first time she moved back in with her dad, like, she grew up very sheltered. She just was one of those young adults who still like very much obeyed her father and like feared him in a sense. Like, he clearly had authority over her. The first time they moved to his house and he was just like, no drinking. And they were like, yes, sir. But yeah. Like, now he literally has no authority over her. And it's, you know, much like how she wasn't able to stop drinking for her daughter. It's just like another step of like,
yeah,
somewhere in one of these book scenes, the dad's talking to Kirsten and he's like low key not condemning her enough, even though she's the only one who's drinking now. He's just like, it's this guy's fault. Don't go back to him. Just get Lila to come here, which is like crazy because I'm like, well, she's still drinking. So like, you're just going to take care of her daughter while she drinks on the side. Like, what is your plan? And this is when we find out that they told Kirsten's dad that Joe burned down the apartment.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah. And she's like, Dad, he's not the one that burned down the apartment. It was me. I feel like knowing that, it's just like another Joe redemption thing. Okay. You know what? If your father-in-law was blaming you for something like that, that you didn't do, and you had to bow down to him every day because of it, when all you actually did was get fired from your job, you know, maybe I would trash someone's greenhouse too. It's like, that's rough.
The whole show is basically just a Joe redemption arc.
Yeah. But at least like with that admission, Kirsten kind of finally convinces her dad that they should not get Lila to move in with them. Joe's doing fine with Lila.
Yeah. And he really is, actually. Like, he's like helping check her homework.
It's sad though, because at this point, like, she's already so independent and she's still only 8. Yeah. Like, all of this happened. The second half of this entire show happens over the course of 1 year, which like I still find hard to wrap my head around. But yeah, it's just sad because even though he is stepping in now, like, she's just already so independent because she has been so far. And even during that brief period when Jim babysits her, he's like, oh, like, let me make you a snack. Let me make you your breakfast, like, that next morning. And she's just like, no, I can do it. She's like turning on stoves and everything.
She literally says, don't worry, I'm used to it.
Yeah.
What's outside your window, darling? What's the latest news?
I'll be there as soon as I can. Be good at school, okay? I'm kissing your forehead. I'm hugging you.
And then I guess like Kirsten sort of works up the courage to go see Lila maybe. And so she goes to a toy store to try to get her a gift of like a, I'm coming back home for the first time. And it's also pretty sad because they're asking her like, what does this girl like? And Kirsten doesn't really know. And they're like, oh, this must be like a niece or a family friend. She's like, no, actually, it's my daughter. She basically says the same things as Joe, where she's like, oh, you know, I'm just a regular person. Maybe I can be forgiven. You know, like, it's not that bad. Because when she does show up at the apartment, she like can't even bring herself to see Lila. She sees Joe and she's like, I need to leave before Lila comes because I'm just not ready to see her. I don't want her to see me like this. And Joe's just like, we just want you to come home. Lila just wants her mom back. And Kirsten just kind of runs away.
Yeah. And then Joe wants to chase her and he's like screaming her name after she runs away. But then he makes the conscious choice to stay with his daughter who's asleep in the other room.
Yeah. And I mean, the show ends with a reprise of There Go I. She talks about how like the first day when they were looking at the water, she's like, oh, the water looks dirty. But then, you know, with some alcohol, it just like everything looks so like shiny and cool. Kirsten just says like, oh, I think the world looks ugly when I'm sober. And that's why I keep drinking, because I want everything to look beautiful. She says the same thing of like, danger, triumph, make me cry. They make me feel it's not ideal, but there go I. It kind of turns into a like, this is the bed that she's made. Like, I don't necessarily think there's like that much hope for her getting sober at this point. She doesn't believe in AA. She obviously can't do it on her own. Her only real reason for doing it would be Lila, but she like can't even bring up the courage to like face Lila at this point. So I feel like it's kind of a bleak ending for her.
I feel like the silver lining is she does finally admit that she has a problem. And even at the toy store, because, you know, the sales associates are kind of like slightly judging her, mostly confused when she doesn't know what her daughter likes. And she's just like, oh, I've been sick for a really long time and I'm seeing her for the first time in a while. So I guess like alluding her alcoholism to sickness is kind of a silver lining there. But it definitely doesn't end in a way where you're like, oh, in a year, she'll come back and be fine. Like, it's very up in the air.
Let me be here tonight. I volunteer tonight. Danger, hazard, make me happy. They make me happy. Don't know why.
Honestly, I was surprised you liked the show. I was ready for you to hate it.
Why?
I mean, part of it was the music, and also like it doesn't really have a super inspirational message to it.
Because, you know, we've also been talking about like dry January, damp January, alcoholism versus kind of like overconsumption culture with alcohol. And I just feel like it's an interesting topic to be putting on Broadway right now, because through lockdown and everything, some people started drinking a lot more, some people started drinking a lot less.
Oh, yeah,
but it's just like a topic that I feel like is kind of relevant right now. It's a heavy topic, but the one act makes it a lot easier. And honestly, like even when I was listening to the album today, I was like, wow, this is a 45 minute album. Like, that's amazing. I can get through Under Death if it's just a 45 minute album. You hear like certain great shows that we love now bombing during like the golden age of musicals because they were real downers. I feel like we're not there anymore. Like, critics especially love downers. And sometimes they do really well, like A Strange Loop.
Yeah. I mean, it was always a limited run, even on Broadway. So I think they knew that it might be tough to convince people to come see a downer on Broadway. Because, like, I think artistically, we appreciate it a lot more now. But because Broadway is still, like, primarily a tourist audience, they probably aren't trying to come see a show about alcoholism. And I saw a lot of jokes about, like, what are they going to serve at the bar at this show? You know, like what is the specialized cocktail going to be?
Were you like, there's no intermission because no one's going to get a drink?
Yeah, pretty much. I did also find it funny when you pointed out that there are no wine or roses in this show.
I know. So is it selling well right now, though?
Honestly, it's not doing great. I think it's one of those shows where they figured it would always be a tough sell. And they just wanted to get it on Broadway for like sort of the prestige and for Tonys and everything. I think the reviews were amazing, though. Out of 11 reviews, 9 positive, 2 mixed, no negative.
That's so very positive.
Yeah.
Do you think they're up for some actor noms?
I think so. So like last episode for Harmony, I mentioned Chip Zion as a best leading actor nom. And I think he probably would still get a nom, but now that Harmony's closed, I think Brian Darcy James goes kind of to the top of the list along with Jonathan Groff for Merrily. Mm-hmm. And I think like Kelly O'Hara, like I really liked her in the show. I thought, you know, she presented a like really complex character as well.
Who would she be competing against?
So there's Eden Espinosa for Limpika, Gail Rankin for Sally in Cabaret, Shayna Taub in Suffs, Malia Joy Moon in Hell's Kitchen, who's playing basically like young Alicia Keys, Ava Noblezada in Great Gatsby, Isabella McCullough in Water for Elephants, the girl in The Wiz playing Dorothy, whose name I do not have right now. But I think like Limpika might be the other main contender, and also maybe Sally in Cabaret, but like I mean, Cabaret's also just been around. So unless she's doing something like insanely new, I kind of don't think she would really win.
I mean, I agree both of them should be pretty up there, like definitely in for nominations, but also very strong contenders for winning. I literally can't imagine this being a two-act musical because I mentioned earlier, song-wise, I just can't imagine it being easy to sing because it's so not melodic.
Right.
So it's like already taxing in that department. And I think acting through these different stages of alcoholism and everything is also just like a pretty taxing thing to do. It was kind of like when we saw Appropriate and I was like, Sarah Paulson must be like fucking exhausted at the end of every night. These are both very exhausting roles, both in the acting realm as well as the singing.
Yeah.
So yeah, they do so much. Like we talk about sometimes when someone does really well, but they just don't do that much. And I just feel like they're both given a lot to do and they're known to be very talented and famous and they did well.
Yeah. And I think the score probably stands a decent chance at getting a nomination just because like I think Adam Gettle's generally well respected. The artistry and craft will probably be appreciated as far as nominations go just because it is doing something different. And like we sort of mentioned, once we started listening to it more, we did really appreciate it.
I mentioned earlier, I know it's a small cast and most of them are barely on stage, but I thought a lot was said with the costumes. I don't really know if it's enough to get them a nomination because they're really just dressing two people in pretty normal street clothes. But I think it really conveyed like each stage of their life really well for both of the characters.
Yeah, I'd agree. Generally like best musical, best book, I think definitely a good chance. Show that definitely can grow on you. Anyway, that is our take on Days of Wine and Roses. So you can follow us for our next episode, probably Back to the Future. And you can follow us on any podcast platform, including the one you're listening to us on now. And if you want to keep up with us on socials, we are Bottomless Bway on both Instagram and Twitter, or you can email us at bottomlessbway@gmail.com. And otherwise, we will be back in 2 weeks.